This is a second on a series on work, and this one is on unions. Are they dinosaurs or phoenix? And how I'd like to start is for us to go around the room quickly and introduce ourselves, what kind of work you do, and if you have any relationship with a union, either on either side of the fence, or if you have a relative in a union or any history, just if you would share that with us quickly so we just get a sense. So you want to start?
No. But I'm retired, Steve Priest, but I was involved with a union.
What union?
It was the Washington State Employees Union. And I worked as an engineer, so.
I'm Darryl Welch, and I'm a systems engineer and not a part of a union. It is not applicable in my company.
I'm Peter Rothog. I am a computer operator for the Postal Service. We're an open shop. In other words, I didn't have to join the unit, and I said, no way.
Okay.
Next.
I'm Barbara Kite, and I work at the Evergreen State College, and I'm a member of the union, and in the 50s and 60s, I was a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers as a telephone operator, and I was a shop stewardess at that time. I had an uncle who was a union organizer, and my uncle who just died a month ago was a wobbly.
Okay. I'll tell you what a wobbly is.
You're next.
I'm Bill Makeley. I'm a retired pastor. Before I went into the pastorate, I taught school a couple of years ago to the school teacher union in Springfield, Ohio.
Okay.
I was the only one that voted for a strike.
Good.
I'm Grant Olson, retired Foreign Service officer, and Uncle Sam does not permit union.
I'm Bob Smith. I'm a retired physician. In the 1970s, I was area medical administrator for United Mine Workers Health and Retirement Fund. Although not a member of the union, I worked closely with the union.
My name is Carl Johnson. I own a small real estate firm in Shelton, so I'm not involved with the union. Before that, I worked for the state of Washington as a forester for 10 years and was not in the union. And just working my way through college, I worked two summers. I had to join the Chicago Flat Janitors Union just to be a summer employee. And that was
the CIU.
That's my only contact with unions ever since. It's
right.
I'm Alan Carlson. I'm still a member of the American Federation of Teachers. I've been retired from teaching for 2 years.
I'm Joyce Carlson. I'm a receptionist at Church and work at unions.
I'm Liz Nave, a former French and Spanish teacher, and I think since I left teaching, they have hooked up with AFL, and I'm a member of the Musicians Union.
I'm Ron Kaplan. I was born in a coal mining town where everybody was a member of the, who wasn't a supervisor, was a member of the union. And I'm in the healthcare field, and I've been involved in organizing healthcare workers in the Seattle area.
Oh, you were with 1199?
Yes.
Right. Your wife mentioned, yeah.
My name is Rick Friedhoff. I'm from Seattle. I'm a lawyer. I've not ever been a member of the union.
My name is Shirley Spong. I'm from Santa Cruz, California. I've never been involved at all with unions. I'm a paralegal.
Sammy Meyer from St. Louis, Missouri. And I work for the church as a national coordinator for the women's movement, no union.
I'm Liz Murphy. I'm a graduate business student and a nurse, so I've really been involved in the movement.
I'm Mary Rowe, and I'm an RN at University Hospital in Seattle, and I've never been involved in the union.
I'm Ralph Miner. I teach in Seattle, and I am a member of the union under duress.
I'm Joanne Holt. My father was a member of a union all his life as a truck driver, and his retirement was through the truck drivers union. I have worked for the Minnesota State Federation of Teachers for developing for the higher education a coach's salary scale and teaching schedule, teaching load, a union won several years ago, and it's now in functional operation in higher education in Minnesota. And I have fought against the union at the University of Maryland and written a couple position papers against it, and so far we haven't.
I'm Linda
Sheskin
from Regina, Saskatchewan. I'm just a student right now, but I've watched my mother fight with the union with SaskTel. It's a Saskatchewan telephone company, and they've been trying to get a contract for the past year or so.
My name is Jim Corkman. I'm studying political science in Regina, Saskatchewan as well. I hope you go to law. During on two summer jobs, I've worked for unions. A meat packing plant as a union, and then I'm working for the government. Well, I was working for the government last two summers.
Leonard Smith, the only union experience I had was one summer at Walla Walla in the Pecanneries, where I was a team member of the Teamsters Union. Although for a long time I was active member of the American Association of University Professors, although we were never a union.
George Sunihiro, and I'm from Spokane, and I worked for the Burlington Northern for 40 years in maintenance labor and temporary track inspector, and I've done gardening and all other jobs.
I'm Dee Priest from Spokane, and I work for the Washington State Department of Transportation as a toll collector on the Maple Street toll bridge, the last toll bridge I think in the state, and we are not affiliated with the union as of now.
I'm Linda Ray Watts. I work for the state of Washington, and I'm a member of the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I'm a shop steward. Today, Governor Gardner is in my office having fun, trying to spend the whole day there because there's some problems, and I'm one of three stewards, and here I sit. The rest of us talk over the problems. And I just have to put in one little plug. The state, in its infinite wisdom, changed our medical plans very recently, gave us next to no notice, practically nil information in time. We're celebrating a union victory. They're going to give us a second open enrollment period, and this time provide enough information. Now that type of issue, your health insurance, is a statewide issue affecting everybody. And it's kind of nice that the union was able to get the state to say, okay, we were kind of dumb here, we'll give you another chance.
Well, my name is Christine George, and I come from a family which wasn't really a union family. I'm first generation. My parents are from Europe, and most of them went into most of my family, my mother's family, which was mostly in this country, and my father mainly went into jobs working in restaurants and grocery stores, what Greeks are always supposed to do, right? And so there wasn't very many unions involved in that situation, although a couple of my uncles, who were piemen, I mean, they delivered pies in restaurants, were members of the Teamsters Union. So I knew something about unions, but it was really something that wasn't primary to my life and to the life of members of my family. At some point, after my father died, my mother became a checkout person in a small grocery store. And they basically, the guy in the grocery store, to keep the union happy, enrolled his employees as members, and they really didn't know what it was. I mean, you know, that they didn't consciously want a union and know what it was. And she never, you know, the steward would come by, who's really a shop rep, about once a year and say how everything was. And my mother would say it was all right, and the other people would say it was all right. And, you know, it wasn't a sense of a movement or a person really representing you or all those things. Although, interestingly enough, when my mother got cancer, and she had that and it took her 3 years to succumb to the disease, that unlike a lot of other people in her economic situation, because she was covered by a union, she had full disability, she had excellent insurance, and that she didn't have that financial burden. And that was really, it was the first time I was in my early 20s that I saw a positive of a union. And I basically, you know, I knew about unions, but they were something out there. You know, really, in this country, there's never been more than 30% membership in unions, and now it's really low. It's about, I think, 17%. And I know in the 70s when it started, it was like 23. So it's gone down. You know, the curve is still going downward. When I was a community organizer, and I decided to go to law school. And the reason I'm telling you this is because a lot of people get involved in things by accidents. I have an accidental view of history. I've definitely had an accidental life in terms of choosing a lot of things. And where I went to work was for a State Department of Labor during the mid-70s. And as a lot of you will remember, the mid-70s were at a period of time in where there was a really mini depression or a recession in this country, and a whole number of people were laid off very dramatically. And in fact, in some ways, we're still recovering from that slump and the economic cycle and trend that it started. And I worked for a small bureaucracy that never had to deal with unemployment. You know, there was sort of the seasonal unemployment, the 4% that always existed. And suddenly they had to deal with a very demanding situation. And the bureaucracy and the management weren't up for it and was really just crumbling. Now, there were a lot of problems there earlier. And for years, people have been trying to get a union in that situation. Public employees, unlike private employees, are not covered by federal labor law. And unless there is a municipal law or a state law which give them rights, they have very few rights to organize. And at that point, that was the case in Illinois. So anyway, I got involved in this, and it was just a crazy situation, and it was a situation which you had to lie to the people coming into the office because you were ordered to lie. And some of us went to the newspapers and said that we would be giving out false information, and some people got fired for that. And we ended up having a wildcat strike, basically, of people in that office. And a bunch of different things happened, came together. I'm not going to go into them, but what basically happened is through that and through other things, after a couple of years, we had a union. And I became involved in that union first as I was elected negotiator, then local union president. And then I went on staff, first as an organizer and a trainer, and later as a negotiator for AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And I really like the union a lot, and I think it's an example of a new, young union in a lot of ways. It hasn't had a lot of the problems. So my background has basically been as someone who got involved in the rank and file level. It met my needs for sanity. It met my needs for being, I don't like to be powerless. I have an aversion to powerlessness. And it was a way for me to try to control and try to change the environment that I was in. And that the union gave me that opportunity. I'm just describing, as I say, what it was for me personally. Later on, as an organizer, and as a negotiator, I represented very different kind of workers. I've represented correctional officers, people who work in mental health facilities, a lot of professionals, a lot of healthcare workers, a lot of people who work for places like social workers, children and family services. And also, I directed some municipal organizing drives towards the end of my tenure in the union, and did a lot of a lot of organizing in what I consider very traditional settings of going and organizing laborers and machinists who work for cities, blue-collar workers. So I have a rather broad view of the situation, and now I'm out of it. And I wanted to share some thoughts I had and also get a discussion going, because I think that you are very representative of a lot of different experiences and a lot of different interactions with unions. And the reason I said dinosaurs in Phoenix is because of the fact, the statistic I just said to you earlier, that unions in this country are decreasing. And it's possible, there's two arguments, that there's one argument that they were relevant at one point in history, and they are no longer relevant, and that there is no need for unions anymore, or their only need for union in small situations. That's one view of unions. The other view of unions is that there is as need of them as before, but the situations have really changed, and they really need to change. And that's basically, and that's the other argument. There's a third argument, which I didn't bring here, which is to say that unions are fine, that what they're doing is perfect and growing, and they don't need to rise out of the ashes. There's no ashes to rise out of. And they're functional, not as a dinosaur, non-functional. Now, there could be an argument with that. I'm not obviously taking that road. I'm saying that there are some problems, and they're either going to mean that unions either are going to become irrelevant or non-functional in this society, or else that they're going to meet the challenge and change. Now, it's interesting, someone said back there, who I think was a university professor, that he belonged to an association, but it didn't become a union. Basically,
the AUP is, at some universities, is a bargaining agent.
Right.
But places where I were, it had no desire to become a bargaining agent.
Some of you know what unions are, but I just want to take a second because I think that's an interesting distinction. That basically what a union is a group of people on one level who get together to represent their interests. Now, for example, I think one of the most powerful unions in this country is the AMA. You know,
AMA meaning?
The American Medical Association. Okay, I mean, in other words, the definition I just gave, it fits that definition. It's a group of people who get together to represent its interests. Now, usually when you mean a union, you add to that fact that they actually negotiate for you. In other words, that somehow that they sit down with an employer for a group of employees and negotiate a contract, which usually defines working conditions and usually defines wages. But many unions for many years have operated just as associations when they don't have the legal right. So there's no legal right in this country to be a member of a union by the Constitution. There's no legal right, and it's not a, it had to be, until the 1930s, there became a law which governed the National Labor Relations Act, which came at the end of the 30s, and then that allowed it to occur. And before that if you could convince an employer through your power, like the power of strike and with withholding your work, through suasion, through getting on their, whatever the reason, that they should negotiate with you and that they should have a contract with their employees, and then it would happen. But if they didn't want to do it, there was no legal way you could force them to do it. Okay? Now, so a lot of public employees to this day only have the right to an association. No one can stop you to belonging to an association. But there are many governmental agencies, for example, the federal government, which there isn't a law saying that they have to negotiate with their employees. So all the Foreign Service officers could want to have a union. They could even have an association of Foreign Service officers that might do research, might do certain things on insurance, might do lobbying for them in some cases. But to sit down and negotiate for them to and have a binding contract, that right now isn't something that there's a legal right. And I just think that that's important to see in terms of unions, that the legal rights and the kind of protection they have of the law are very important. And when you don't have the protection, you have the kind of situation which happened with the, I just forgot the name, you know, the people who...
Air traffic controllers.
They had a right to an association, but they could only go so far. They didn't have the legal right to go any further. So the president could get away with firing them. You know, if they had worked for private industry what the president had done would have been considered an unfair labor practice. So as long as there have been workers, I would say, as long as there have been people whose basic way of working has been their labor, you know, that they didn't own property, that they had labor, that usually that they've gotten together in associations. And sometimes those associations have been like guilds, you know, that they passed down knowledge of their and did trading. Artisans did that, started in the Middle Ages. I mean, that was always, there's always people have gotten together in associations. That's always been something that people did. In this country, workers to protect themselves. See, I think people are inherently conservative. And so most people don't want to belong to unions. They don't want to rock the boat. They want everything to be nice and easy. And so usually people don't get involved in unions unless, or get involved in associations when things don't work. So the first unions, I think with miners and a lot of groups like that, were actually widow and orphans organizations. In other words, that the employer didn't take care of the employees once they got hurt on the job or if they were killed. And so the workers started to basically join together to have like insurance funds to give money so that if they died, and then they would there would be some money for the widows and orphans. You know, or there'd be insurance programs, or there'd be some retirement money. And then from there, that went on in a lot of situations to say, we want certain things. We want the 8-hour day. We want a 5-day week or a 6-day week. And things like that. And the one thing that they had, the one power they had was the ability to withhold their labor, which is what a strike is. Okay, and so there's been a lot, and in this country, there's been a lot of bloody fights in order to establish unions. And employers have not very easily, especially in the 1800s, given the right for employees to have unions. What happened in the 1930s, moving real quickly, is that there were certain powerful unions. The mine workers unions was one of them that had gotten a foothold. These guys didn't have any other choice. And basically it was men organizing. There have been some very strong organizations of women, but they didn't last as long, partially because women moved in and out of the job force a whole lot. So you had strong unions, and then you had, in the 30s, you had a government, a president, who was interpreted as being friendly to unions, which was Roosevelt. And the combination of the Depression, the combination of a few strong unions that were going to organize, and the comment of saying, the president wants you to be in the union, all those things together built the union movement in this country. During the 30s and 40s, until the unions became important. And they especially became important in the transportation industry and in the manufacturing industry, which are basically mail industries, which were basic blue collar, and that it was enormously important for those industries. And the workers in those industries were able to really have their wages go up. They were also able to work out of a panchement with the employers and work out a situation of bargaining that even though there were strikes and stuff like that, that basically they lived with each other. You know, and it was a fact of life that, you know, that Ford and Chrysler and all these people would sit down and negotiate. And they had, going through the 50s, a situation was working fine. Now, what started to happen and which gets, and what's happening now is a couple of different things. The first thing that happened is a change of employment patterns. You see, the unions organized this group of people. After that, didn't put very much money in organizing at all. They didn't go out. They didn't care about the people, in my opinion, who weren't organized. You know, some small unions did. But basically, they'd organized in their industry. They weren't as concerned about the clerical workers, for example. They weren't as concerned about public employees or other things. There were some unions trying to do that. But the old unions, the UAW, represented auto workers, and they were fairly well satisfied as long as they continued to represent auto workers. Now, what happened is suddenly it was cut from under them by the change of employment patterns. As more and more manufacturing went abroad, as the kind of work changed in this country, that suddenly that base was gone. And you have a situation like in Illinois, which is where I'm, where there are, you know, half the members of the UAW that there were, that's United Auto Workers, who basically in Illinois represented farm implement people who made, you know, Deere tractors and stuff like that. And half of them were gone because the jobs were gone. So that's why you're having this downtrend. At the same time, what's happened in this country is that service industries have grown and women and minorities have entered the workforce. And unions were not known as places where women and minorities were welcome. It was basically, there was the view of unions as a white male thing. But what also started, so that's what sort of occurred. Now, actually, unions should have gone down more than only being 17%. But what's happened is that the women and minorities, basically blacks, who are getting a sense of empowerment from things that were happening outside of the unions, which were happening in the women's movement and which were happening in the civil rights movement, started to take those concerns to their jobs. There were certain unions, AFSCME was one of them, there are other unions, 1199, which is works with hospital workers, is another union that was grew in New York, and that they started to organize the nurses' union, the INA, which was an association, suddenly started to think about negotiating contracts, and now it's one of the largest unions in this country. Another union that was, AFSCME started out as an association and started growing. So you started to have all of these new organizations starting, and they have grown tremendously. They have doubled and tripled their membership among people who you wouldn't think of as union members. In other words, among professionals, among clerical workers. And that has grown. But at the same time, the big base, the core, has fallen apart. But most of the unions that are sitting there are still thinking in 1940s and 1950 terms. And they still, they don't know how to change. They don't know how to use new forms of communication. In a lot of cases, and their money, they've become high-powered bureaucracies, and often pay their the organizer is the least person on the totem pole rather than the highest person on the totem pole, if that makes any, and that's a real important difference in terms of pay, in terms of prestige. Less money goes into organizing, not of the unions that are growing, but of the majority of unions, and so that's sort of the situation that exists. Then you also have a situation that most people in this country are individualistic. We think we should be able to make things for ourselves. And we do not have a tradition as they do in Europe, for example. I mean, unions are much more normal in Europe. You know, for example, IBM. I'm just using this because you said you were a systems engineer. Do you know that the unions in all the IBM plants in Scandinavia are unionized?
I did not know that.
Yeah. And I was totally shocked. I said, and didn't IBM fight that, I asked, because a friend of mine is Danish. And she said, no, because everybody is unionized in Denmark. So when IBM built something in Denmark, it didn't care. You know, it was like the status quo for its workers to be unionized. When if you tried to, even if you could get a foothold in IBM to organize in this country, they would fight it. You know? It's a real different situation. There's a real different culture. Yeah.
I'm IBM also. I think we were organized in Puerto Rico, if I'm not mistaken. But that's all.
Yeah, I don't know about Puerto Rico, but I remember I was so shocked that that IBM in Denmark was organized. I mean, actually, unemployment compensation in Denmark is run. If you're unemployed, you have to go to the union office to get your unemployment check. I mean, there's actually some relationship with the government that has developed. Yeah.
In Europe, it's not only normal, and they're not only bargaining, but they share in power and decision making, which is just unheard of in this country.
Right. It's a very different situation, which leads to the second thing, which is hostile politics, which is something, is that there's a sense of organization, and I don't. There's no time. I mean, it could be a whole lecture. I mean, it could be a whole two-year course. There's a sense of organization. I'm just taking Northern Europe, for example. because it's most comparable to this country in a whole lot of ways, that isn't the same tradition here. Here we have the much more small business tradition, the individual making it, I don't know. And in Europe, it's sort of naturally assumed that you'll be in organizations and that those organizations will do things. I mean, it's like you say, there's a partnership that just doesn't exist in this country. So that it's like, it's not natural to think politically or individually that there would be a union. And that's the opposite, yeah.
Those attitudes, and I've spent many years in northern organizations to which the individual unions belong. Then there's a discipline that exists, and the contract may be 3 years, which means that IBM Denmark has 3 years of labor peace.
I know, and in this country has one of the bloodiest histories. You know, it's an interesting situation that in Europe, where you have over 50% membership in many of the countries in terms of unions, that there isn't a very bloody or abrasive history. I mean, this is where, when I was going to St. Louis, actually, and I had to stop off to see Mother Jones. I don't know if you know about Mother, I mean, you might know the magazine Mother Jones. Mother Jones was a woman who lived in the turn of the century, a widow woman, who was an organizer for the United Mine Workers. And so I went to the cemetery in which she had been buried, and I didn't, you know, it's this little town about 60 miles east of St. Louis, and then there was just all these graves. It was the Union County Cemetery, and there were all of these graves and all of these monuments, really touching poems and things of so-and-so, age 35, killed in this massacre. So-and-so, age 30, killed in this massacre, left these kids. I mean, there was bloody warfare in southern Illinois, which has a lot of coal mines. And that, like I said, that tradition and that abrasiveness is really the history of the labor movement in this country. Now, some people, in fact, have attributed the fact that the unions have been weak in the last 10 years to the Reagan administration, and clearly what happened earlier on among the air control, I want to say flight attendants, I know that's true, air controllers is part of it, but it's really management in this country has decided that because the unions were getting weaker, because there was being a change in the workforce, that they were going to get a lot more hostile to unions. They have IBM in this, IBM in this country has decided that it can fight unions and it is going to make it real hard for unions. Here's an interesting statistic, that if an employer stays neutral, if I, as a union organizer, go into the situation and the employer stays neutral, you know, says, I'm not for the union, but I'm not against the union, 95% of those elections will go for union. However, if the employer becomes hostile, and by hostile, I mean tries to fire some people or transfer them and people get scared, only 47% of the time will the employees elect a union. So the employer has a great deal of power to influence a situation and influence people. I think that the reasons that, as I said, that the problem that exists is the workforce has changed. In America, that unions don't have the toehold that they've had in other parts of the world. And like I said, we could do the whole psychology of America to discuss that, and maybe some people want to comment on it. And also that the unions some of the unions have had their own internal problems and have not moved fast enough. But the question is, do Americans need unions enough, and are the unions going to change enough that there will be a resurgence of unions in this country? Will there be phoenixes or will there be dinosaurs? And that's the question, and I'm real curious for some of you. I have an opinion, which I'll tell you at the end, but what do you think? Do you think that unions are going to function in a society, that there's a need for unions anymore?
Well, I just keep thinking about the Eastern Airline problem, which is a terrible problem, which is basically the union and Eastern management, and there's no solution, and it's just getting worse and worse. So to me, it seems that that union isn't doing any good at all.
Other people think about the Eastern situation?
Can I ask you, in what way is the union is the union harmful to that?
Well, I guess the only example I know is a baggage handler at Eastern Airlines that takes your luggage makes $42,000 a year. And that is the downfall of Eastern Airlines. I mean, that kind of job, paying that kind of money, where other airlines don't have that arrangement with their unions, it's an arrangement that Eastern happens to have, and they can't get out of it.
So basically, it seems like the union was too successful for the airline's own good.
Right, that's why.
So they have a contract that's significantly different than the other contracts with other airlines.
They definitely do.
That are more profitable.
Exactly. And this is a real fact.
I think he raises a good point in some ways, in a lot of ways, because I think the unions to be successful need a positive public perception. That they're doing, that it's a just cause when they're causing inconvenience to consumers or certainly inconvenience to themselves and their families by going on strike or making demands, that it's for a just cause. And oftentimes you hear people say, why should I support these baggage handlers or these pressmen who work for these newspapers who are fighting automation, who are who want more money and yet are making $20,000 more a year than I'm making. And
well, the absurd example of that is the NFL strike.
Exactly, I was just going to bring that. The football players, that's a union. They had to strike.
I mean, look, it's a bad example, but
they're a group of people. Yeah. And now this year, there's the union lost last year. Now the individuals are doing their wildcat strikes.
You're talking about the unions that aren't very enlightened. I happen to be associated with a number of unions, and you take the nurses, which my wife is a member of, they are just royally getting screwed, and there's no question about it, and you don't have a shortage of nurses in this country. You have a shortage of nurses who are willing to work for the money you pay them.
That's right.
And I'm a university professor, and I work with kids in placement and jobs. I can put a kid out in a job that'll make as much as my wife after 20 years in the business in nursing. And she's got to deal with AIDS patients and the whole fear of that whole thing. And I get a 22-year-old kid, and they make as much money. And the nurses are going around, and everybody's saying, oh, they're rich. That's baloney.
I agree.
They're just getting nailed. And
you should get a job organizing.
I get irritated on the health care because everybody says it's too expensive. But those nurses just don't get a fair shake. My wife works way harder than I do. I'm not bragging I have a lazy job, but my job is 20 times easier than hers, and it's just no question about it.
Is she a member of any kind of organization?
Yeah. I think part of it is the women don't have enough guts to do anything about it.
Yes. Is
that the guts? I think that they just don't have a history of working power. Together and getting the power, and so they're not willing to take it. Yeah, I think...
I fight harder at work than my wife does about that. She can, they get a little...
Well, and then nurses' personalities, I suppose,
right.
In general.
It's supposed to be a helping profession, and the idea that you would stop helping...
Because the person's drunk, who's going to suffer but your patients, and that's what you're there for.
Well, and who promotes that attitude is the American Medical Association.
Right.
So you have the American Medical Association fighting nurses tooth and nail, and it's all men, and they're saying, what kind of people are you if you let your patients die, and you strike, and how do you... respond to that.
I get the impression that unions suffer Canada, and I think there's a lot more union activity.
There is a lot more union activity in Canada.
And, I'm really surprised to hear that Eastern airline attendants are making this much while other airline attendants aren't making as much. Like in Canada, like just for example, one of the summer jobs I was on, the union I was in was all meat packers and all food processing. Like that was for I think three provinces, and it's just this huge union. All the people who processed food were in this union. All the people who worked in department stores were in this union, and some, though not all, people who work in grocery stores were in this union as well. So there wasn't a competition of the unions in between, like one union fighting another one.
I think that, I just want to just, the point of public perception, which we'll get back to, the organization of the unions, and I'm going to use the word consciousness of, and I'm misspelling it, of the employees, what they, what their sense of what they can do, their sense of power in a, you know, of the workers are really key points. But there was some other hand, yeah.
Can you explain this dichotomy which seems to exist? I always thought one of the basic principles of unionism was solidarity. And yet within the unions themselves, there seems to be even more competition than there is between industrialists. Take the Eastern Airlines case as an example. You don't find the baggage handlers from TWA or United or American or any other of the other airlines going out in support of the Eastern Airlines baggage handlers. You don't find the stewardesses from these other airlines going out in support of the TWA hostesses, which have been fighting with Carl Icahn for over 5 years, I believe. Mm-hmm. What is the basis for this?
I think there's a couple of different reasons for it. One thing I want to say before I give you the reasons is it's real interesting because we're talking about a lot of negatives of unions, right? I mean, a lot of weaknesses of unions.
Right.
I have found in places of working of them being more solid with each other and more supportive in terms of giving money when, like, there's a strike of giving extra money than a lot of other associations I belong to. So there is a tradition of that. But it is really hampered by two things. Again, in Europe, like, again, I'm taking Scandinavia, all of one kind of profession is represented by the same union. You know, you don't have 17 different unions competing for that one profession. Now, what they do is they have political parties and caucuses within the unions, and they fight like, you know, they're like political parties to see who's going to have office. But it's a different kind of competition. You know, so that the people who are more social democrat will fight the people who are more communist or the people who are more liberal to see who'll get control of that union in the elections every period of time. But they're all together. And that's true in most countries except the United States. And I think part of it is our individualism, you know, which has a good side and a bad side. And the other reason for, and the other, and that individualism has historically been built into the unions. So there's all these separate little organizations. And there's, and the AFL-CIO is not very strong. In other words, the power the AFL-CIO has over its individual members in reality is very, very weak. So that if suddenly the Washington, I don't know who, that I know this is true in Illinois, and when suddenly the Illinois employees wanted to be unionized, the SEIU and AFSCME went after each other's throats, and the Teamsters were in there. You know, I spent as much time fighting the Teamsters as an organizer as I did fighting management. You know, so that situation happened. But also what happens is this, is that because they're individual unions and they're chopped up that way, and because the law is written the way it is, that if he's a baggage handler and he goes out and strike, and then I say, I'm going to be a solid union person, and I'm not going to cross his picket line, I can then be legally fired. Because we're not covered by the same contract. See, the structure is done in such a way. Now, if my own union is on strike, the contract that I'm under, and then I can't cross the picket line, and then I'm protected by labor law. But if he's on strike, and I don't cross his picket line, that doesn't happen. So that the law here is a lot less limited, and the way it was designed earlier on, and people haven't overcome it yet. And I personally think that until it's restructured and we make changes like that, it's going to be very hard, and you're going to get the kind of craziness that you don't see in Canada, which has a much higher union membership, you know, and that you do see here. The other thing which has happened in this country is that part of the agreement during the 50s, I think, with the employers, was what we'll do is we don't care what you're doing as management, what your investment policy is, what your long-range planning is, as long as we get the pay raises. And we've learned that that doesn't work, because then the company will make management decisions and you'll be out of work. Or in many cases, as with nurses and a lot of professionals, not that they don't care about wages, but they also care about working conditions. You know, and also, like for teachers, that a lot of times, yes, they want higher wages, but they also want small class sizes. You know, and so unless those demands can start being part of what you're asking for, you know, you're not going to capture the imagination of the employees, but also you're not going to make big PR. And I want to say something. I want you all, if you remember, one assignment, to look in the newspapers whenever they talk about unions. You'll notice that they always say, union boss Doug Frazier, and then they'll say, business leader Lee Iacocca. Do they ever say, business boss Lee Iacocca, union leader Doug Frazier? I mean, there's a lot of interesting things that our press does, and then the unions don't do a very good job of PR, but that's in place. Yeah. There was a hand right here somewhere I saw. Motion? No?
Yeah. I think the issue raises, especially with nurses, about, you know, primarily in most of the service employees, a lot of clerical workers, now women are beginning to have a major role as part of that workforce, and they don't have this tradition of being organized. They don't have a role of thinking in terms of a long-term job. Traditionally, women have had jobs, then maybe they've left their career, you know, put off their careers to raise a family, then maybe they've gone back to work to supplement an income, but they've never viewed themselves as being a primary income earner. And then they have to think about benefits and about health insurance and about the future health of the industry or the business they're working in. And I think that's an important factor. First of all, that they lack the history of being in the workforce, and also the fact that they lack the history of organizing, and there are probably some other factors going on which you brought about that they're not used to standing up for the rights.
Well, we're not socialized. We're socialized to be nice people. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're not socialized to be competitive.
Shouldn't use that word. That's a bad word, socialized.
I like it. But you know, in terms of that, and in terms of the thing that you were saying, in terms of women being, I think that's one reason now that the growth industry is among women in terms of unions, is for that very fact that they're beginning to see those kinds of things, even though women now do look at themselves, and they are, I mean, either their paycheck is as important, and they know that. They know that just because that, you know, a family can't exist in one paycheck these days, and so if they're married, they are going to have to, they're going to be in the labor force for a long time, and if they're divorced or they're single head of household, they know that there's no other paycheck than their own. So the situation is beginning to slowly change. And I think that has been changing since the 60s, and that's why most of the growth has been in terms of women. I also think that management in this country, in terms of women, like on the issue, I guess the forum tomorrow night is going to be on sexual harassment, but that a lot of the places where sexual harassment has been pointed out first, where the issue of pay equity was pointed out first, was within the union movement. I mean, pay equity in Washington State, and correct me if I'm wrong, was because of unions. In other words, the unions lobbied the legislature to say, we want to have a study. I mean, that didn't happen, you know, sort of an idea. We'll do a study just to see, let's see how women's wages compare to male wages. I mean, there was a concentrated effort by unions to say, let's look at that. And voila, they found that men's wages were in professions, that occupations that were majority male, that the wages were much higher than in professions that are majority female. Yeah.
She and I were just mentioning to ourselves that we were the first state in the nation and our union wanted comparable work. Now, for some of us, at the higher part of the women's scale, it hasn't been a lot of benefit. But we've seen some benefit, and for a lot of people, it made a lot of difference. And there really was an argument, but it was proven that those occupations in state government that were largely predominated by men, less hard, less difficult, requiring less education, got so much more money. And there has been an adjustment based upon formulas of how hard is it, how much education, what are the responsibilities, and there's been a bit of a change.
But, you know, it's interesting about that. When you look back historically, you know, is it the society is so sexist that they give men better wages than they give women? I mean, that's open to question. But historically, one of the reasons that those professions, see, on the whole, state employees' rates were based on, they say, are based on marketplace rates. In other words, they pay electrician in state employment what is supposed to be the market rate for electrician in the state as a whole, and they pay a nurse, I'm just, the market rate. But what happened is that the electricians have a history, the plumbers have a history, the bricklayers have a history, the janitors have a history of being in unions, and therefore every year going back to the trough and getting a pay raise. The nurses don't have that history. So what happened is it turns out that one of the reasons isn't just because they're men, but because they came from occupations that had a history of unionization. So that their wages got up, and the wages for women were never unionized and never got up. I think there's other things beyond that there. But that is one of the reasons, when you look back in the situation, that those wages were a lot better off. You know, why the electrician at the mental health hospital that I was representing, who did absolutely, positively nothing, I mean, really, I don't mean electricians do nothing, but this particular... The definition of electrician in this situation, they said it needed an electrician, it really didn't, was making one-third more money than the nurses who were supervising 50 people. And it was because of the accident of history. It wasn't looking at what they were doing and what he was doing. You know, it was merely saying, well, this is what electricians get in general society, and this is what nurses get in general society. Yeah.
Why have the union movement generally in the state developed a bad reputation because of people like Tony Boyle and the mine workers and predecessors perhaps to Jackie Presser in the Teamsters, and there are probably others that we could cite.
But why, I want to ask you a question. Why, I'm going to ask everyone, why is it that the unions got a bad, because of Tony Boyle, I'm going to say Tony, you know, or because of Jackie Presser, and why is it that corporations...
Well, the same reason that Richard Nixon got a bad reputation from the American public in the 70s, seems to me.
No, but as a whole, we have a sense that unions are corrupt and non-functional, right? I mean, there's a press thing that they get a bad paper.
Well, if you have a Tony Boyle at the head, who's
right?
Well,
but let me just finish. But no, I'm not disagreeing. I'm not disagreeing about Tony Boyle. I mean, I'm not trying to defend that person. But what I'm saying is that those people define the union movement more than John L. Lewis defines the union movement, for example. On one hand, and yet, if you look at what Carnegie did, place I work for gets money from the Carnegie Foundation. But what the original Carnegie did, or what the original Ford did, or if you look at if you even look at the guys who were, what was it, Nestle's, or what was the, do you know the company, the Gerber's Food or Nestle's, who were selling
Beechnut.
Yeah, and were selling apple juice and saying it was apple juice and it was just colored water. Mm-hmm. You know that doesn't seem to change our perception of corporations in quite the same way that those other people. See, I would say there's as much corruption both ways. And I'm just saying, I don't. Why is it that unions are more tainted?
I think it's like you were talking about the American identity before, you know, the individual. You know, I don't need a union. I can go out and I can work for myself. You know, I'm a sense of pride and everything. And I think it's. That ties into an almost paranoia. I don't think it exists as much anymore of communism than of anything that's remotely socialist. Like you said, that's a bad word. You shouldn't say socialist.
Why is this
a bad word? You know, it shouldn't be a bad word. And unions are by nature left wing. Like they're a socialist. They're a collective thing. And I think people associate unions with that far left, and they see it as a threat to the American way of life and a threat to America.
I guess I don't see it that way. I think more the people that are the union bosses that have gotten in trouble, people see that they have a higher fiduciary duty. Most of the funds that they deal with are other people's money. And I think the businessmen who deal with other people's money and misuse it get in just as much trouble as the union guys. I mean, I think the pension plans of the Teamsters, for example, have been, you know, as corrupt and as misused as they could be. And that's somebody else's money that these people are in charge of, and they've misused it. And so I guess I don't see that it's unfair that they get that bad a rap
for doing that kind of stuff. I wouldn't say that they get that bad a rap. I'm just saying that I'm wondering percentage-wise. I'm making a statement that I think percentage-wise there's as many corrupt heads of corporations as there are corrupt people in unions. I would say that the one isn't better than the other. But I think that unions on the whole, because of that it's more likely that we're going to see them in a negative groove. Mm-hmm. You know, that our public view of them is such.
But if only 70% of the population is a member of that group, the others aren't, that would be normal. I don't do that. I look at a union like Tony Boyle's a corrupt bad. I do some arbitration with the Teamsters. Mm-hmm. And I know there's some bad guys in Teamsters. There's some really good guys in mm-hmm. Teamsters. And I sort that out. But if I got somebody over here, it's a non-union, why wouldn't they look at the Teamsters as bad?
Right.
I mean, it only makes sense to me. If they're not a part of that system, they don't sort out, they don't have the history, the tradition of the union.
The bell rang, I think.
I know. I just want to say two things. One is I think it goes back to public perceptions, and I think you're right. But I think that there's a real need for associations in this country and for unions. I think that employees should have a right to choose, and some will choose not to. But the need for that needs to be strengthened. I think the laws need to be strengthened, and I think the unions also have a responsibility to basically get into the 20th century. I want to recommend this book, which is called Working by Studs Terkel. And it is the greatest book to read about different work experiences, both union and non-union and everything, and to get a sense of what work is in America.